It's Thursday, March 24, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. What exactly are we trying to do in Libya? How exactly are we going to try to achieve the goals? How will we know if we are successful? And with whom exactly do we think we're working? Who is it on the ground we're actually trying to help? All these questions remain in play days after the United States, joined by the air forces of the United Kingdom and France, began an effort that was supposedly to provide cover for ground forces in an insurgency against Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi. Now, what makes this situation even more confusing is that now it appears that the Allies are not so allied as we were told at the beginning, and furthermore, the situation may now be clear that the different countries that are involved in this military action have very different goals, very different aims, and for that matter, very different understandings of how what we're doing there is to be accomplished. Now, that is not unusual in a time of protracted war. But of course, this is not, at least at this point, a time of protracted war. It's at the beginnings of a military effort that is supposed to be almost immediately over. President Barack Obama told the United States people that the effort that is now undertaken by the United States Air Force would be superseded by others within, as he said, not a matter of weeks, but a matter of days. Well, we're now uncertain as exactly how that's going to take place. But there's a very interesting angle on this that is brought out by columnist Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. Now, Maureen Dowd is an avowed feminist. She's also one of the most insightful columnists in terms of the paper that is still the most influential newspaper in the United States. In her article entitled Flight of the Valkyries, Maureen Dowd points out that there was a gender divide in the Obama administration in terms of this military action. And the gender divide had women calling for the military action and men generally resisting. Now, there are several women named in her article, and those close to the situation verify that the pressure that came on the Obama administration from inside the administration to take military action was led especially by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and two of her advisors, in particular, Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and Samantha Power, a national security aide, who is also the author of an award-winning book about genocide. As Helene Cooper, the White House correspondent, told Meet the Press, quote, "The girls took on the guys." Now, one of the interesting angles on all of this is the fact that the women in the Obama administration seem to be the hawks, and the men, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, seem to be very reluctant to enter into military action in this case. Now, we've talked about the issue of liberal interventionism. It is generally caused by, or at least led by, those who say that we must intervene in order to serve some humanitarian mission. But the military is often not well equipped to do this. Now, one of the precedents that is often cited here is the action of the United States after years of inaction in the Balkans as Muslims are being massacred by the Serbs. Well, it did become clear that the action by the United States did make a difference. But the problem was how exactly the United States and its allies get out of a situation once it intervenes. We'll be watching this one closely. It is not likely true that the President of the United States is going to be right when he says that the American involvement here is going to be a matter of days, not weeks. The real danger here is that it is a matter not of weeks, but months. And if previous precedents are any indication, over the long term, at some level, it could be not only months, but years. It is very difficult to define when exactly a situation is sufficiently stable. In a very unstable world, how are we to think about this? Well, one way to look at it is to consider world history. And one way to consider world history is that there have been isolated moments. You might see it as a sea of rather chaotic and catastrophic cultural events with some separated islands of great domestic peace. The danger is that we will think ourselves able to bring peace where there is no peace. On the other hand, the interventionists have a point when they suggest that a failure to seek to make the peace may make us complicit with murder and mayhem on the ground. In the year 1914, Henry Ford offered workers in Detroit $5 a day, sparking a radical growth in the city of Detroit that led that nation at one point to become the fourth largest city in America, right about the midpoint of the 20th century. But data just released by the U.S. Census Bureau indicates that the current population of Detroit is just 713,777. That's lower than at any point prior to that decision by Henry Ford to spark the Industrial Revolution in Detroit with the manufacture of automobiles. Earlier this week, the Census Bureau revealed that the city of Detroit has lost approximately 25% of its population over the last 10 years. One resident has moved away every 22 minutes between the years 2000 and 2010. Now, this is a devastating demographic shift for one of America's major cities. But it goes beyond just the situation in Detroit. Detroit is, in this case, a microcosm of major shifts in the American economy. Now, we can look at this and recognize that there is tremendous loss, the losses of literally hundreds of thousands of jobs ricocheting through the automotive economy and falling home prices that have been nearly catastrophic. But the larger picture here is of the great economic transformation of our current times. We need to look back at Detroit and recognize that it is the great symbol of America's industrial might during the 20th century. It was Detroit and its assembly lines that turned out the great engines of democracy during the First and especially the Second World Wars. It was Detroit that became the great symbol of industrialized labor and of the power of labor unions. But Detroit is now a very different picture. It's a picture of what happens when an economic transformation can leave a city behind. We need to recognize that an economy is, of course, a great moral instrument. It is also a tremendous engine of moral change. The Soviet Union, for instance, demonstrated the disaster of an attempt at central economic planning. It turns out that a government, or any agency for that matter, is woefully incompetent to manage an economy. But as an economy is made up of the decisions made by literally millions of persons, acting more as a crowd than in concert, you come to understand the limitations of any kind of economic planning. It wasn't so much that Detroit did anything wrong. It wasn't so much that other cities did anything right. It has to do with the shift from an industrial economy to an information economy, and the fact that you do not need vast factories and you do not need vast armies of hourly workers in order to achieve the mega billions that are possible in an information economy. Now, the situation in Detroit is one of the grave questions facing the United States. It's not just Detroit, it's any number of cities that are going to have shrinking populations in years to come. Some of America's most important cities have populations that are smaller now than they were 10 years ago and are almost surely to be significantly smaller 10 years from now. They include cities like New Orleans, which is explainable mostly by the hurricane known as Katrina, but then cities added to Detroit that include Cleveland, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Toledo, St. Louis, Chicago, Baltimore, and even Santa Ana, California. In the scope of world history, America is still a relatively young nation. It has not had the experience of seeing cities rise and fall with the kind of pattern we now see in Detroit and perhaps in several other cities as well. We're going to have to learn some lessons about ourselves as we watch some of our own cities, those cities that have become badges of American honor and pride, suffering under the transformations of a new period of economic change. The state of South Dakota has adopted one of the most important anti-abortion laws of recent decades. Now signed into law by South Dakota's governor, Dennis Daugaard, the state now requires women seeking an abortion to go to a consultation at a pregnancy help center in order to learn what is available to them in order to help the mother keep and care for her child. Now, this puts the state of South Dakota in something other than a morally neutral position on the question of abortion. It clearly puts this state and its government on the side of seeking to preserve and to protect human life. Now, of course, you now have the abortion rights activists who are up in arms claiming that it is wrong for a state or a government to have a stake in the matter. But that's insanity. What nation, what state, what government has there ever been that did not have a stake, an avowed stake, in the lives and in the flourishing of its own citizens? That is, if anything, the purpose for which a government exists, first of all, ordained by God, but also is recognized even in secular societies. Now, how extreme are the abortion activists on this question? Well, just consider an editorial that ran earlier this week in USA Today. On the topic of abortion, the subject matter was, quote, "New wave of abortion laws limits women's right to choose." In other words, the absolutist position that the real issue here is just a woman's right to choose is so cherished by those who are the extremists on this question that they simply will not even abide the idea that a woman might be counseled into a different decision. Notice it's counseling, not coercion. And that tells you in this case what the real agenda is. Certainly from a Christian perspective, but also over a perspective of world history, it is clear that governments exist, first of all, to protect their citizens. And if that does not include unborn citizens, it will not include others as well. Ratings are out indicating that the cable news network CNN led in terms of cable news viewing over the last viewing period. Why? Well, most persons believe it is because of the network's coverage of events in Japan and Libya. Fox News had been leading by a wide margin. It fell into second place. But MSNBC, with its liberal political commentary, nearly collapsed in the ratings. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that it does cost a lot to field the kind of international reporting team that CNN has as its pride and joy. It also tells us something else. When events as important as what has been going on in Japan and Libya capture the attention of the public, they have far less time to be distracted by the kind of endless political chatter that fuels a great deal of the cable news. That should tell us something about just how morally serious some Americans are, even when their networks are not. CNN will probably have a difficult time remaining in first place because when the need for their international reporters begins to lessen, so also will its viewership probably shrink. But in the meantime, it tells us something good about the American people, that they have at least something of an instinct about what's really important. And when it comes to cable news, that instinct seems to be reflected in their viewing pattern. Finally, when it comes to human nature, we probably should already know what is in a new report out from the journal Social, Psychological, and Personality Science. It tells us that when it comes to exercising self-control, human beings seem to have limits. When we tighten down in one area of our lives, it turns out an amazing number of us decide to give some margin in some other area of our lives. That's one of the real problems, isn't it? As we look at ourselves in the mirror, and certainly as we look at ourselves within the pages of Scripture, we find ourselves unable even to manage ourselves as we believe we should. But then again, that's exactly what the Apostle Paul told us in Romans chapter 7. He could not believe what he saw himself doing, even as he set his mind to do something else. That's why when you come to the end of Romans chapter 7, the Apostle Paul asks this question, "Who shall rescue me from this body of death?" And then comes the answer, "Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord." We cannot rescue ourselves, even when it comes to something like self-control. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com, where today you'll find a very important article in which I engage emerging church leader Brian McLaren on some of the most important questions of the Christian faith. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you today from Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.